Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI appeals to delegates attending this week's UN Climate Change Conference to craft a responsible and credible deal to cut greenhouse gases that takes into account the needs of the poor. One participant at the just-started Climate Change Conference in Durban speaks of her hopes and expectations regarding the event. Film critic Peter Malone takes us into the fascinating world of The First Grader, a film that gives a moving account of an old man in Kenya who wants to learn to read. And Father Jim Brand looks ahead to the second week of Advent with a particular thought for those who spend the Christmas season in loneliness. Pope Benedict XVI called on Sunday for delegates attending this week's UN Climate Change Conference in South Africa to craft a responsible and credible deal to cut greenhouse gases, taking into account the needs of the poor. Some 25,000 government officials, lobbyists and scientists are expected to attend the two-week conference that opened on Monday in Durban. Sean Patrick Lovett tells us more.
Pope Benedict expressed the hope that all members of the international community might reach agreement on a responsible, credible response to the phenomenon of climate change, which he described as complex and disturbing. In remarks following the Sunday Angelus, the Holy Father also asked that leaders' response be consonant with the spirit and requirements of solidarity, taking into account the needs of the poorest people and future generations. His remarks came ahead of a UN climate change conference, which begins today in Durban, South Africa. South Africa's International Relations Minister, Maeting Koana Mashabane, is chairing the conference.
It is predicted that climate change will cause an increase in the frequency and intensity of natural disasters such as floods and droughts, threatening food security.
At stake is the future of the Kyoto Accord, which calls on wealthy nations to reduce carbon emissions 5% below 1990 levels by the end of next year. Poor countries want the industrial nations to commit to more cuts for a second period, but wealthy countries say they cannot carry the burden alone and want rapidly developing countries like China, India, Brazil and South Africa to slow their emissions growth and move toward low-carbon economies. Also high on the conference agenda is the management of the Green Climate Fund, worth $100 billion annually, to help poor countries cope with changing climate conditions. I'm Sean Patrick Lovett.
Thanks there to Sean Lovett for that report. Meanwhile, hundreds of campaigners, farmers and pastoralists from all over Africa travelled more than 4,000 miles and crossed 10 countries on their way to join the UN climate talks in Durban. The coach convoy, called the Trans-African Caravan of Hope, set off from the Burundian capital Bujumbura on November the 9th and picked up people all along the journey's 17-day route. Some of those travelling on the caravan come from communities affected by the drought crisis in East Africa. They're taking their stories of the impacts of climate change to African and other world leaders at the climate change talks in Durban. Amongst them, there are the three CAFOD partners from Kenya. I spoke to Sarah Wykes, CAFOD's lead analyst on climate change and environmental issues, about the initiative. I asked her, first of all, why has it been called a caravan of hope?
It's actually our partners who have come up with the whole concept for this caravan. We have three CAFOD partners from different dioceses who are in Kenya that are actually on the caravan, plus the representative from our East Africa office in Nairobi. And the idea is basically that this is a very difficult time in terms of the prospects of dealing with climate change. I think many people feel that this is an absolutely huge challenge and that there's not much effective action from governments at the moment. So I think the message is to say, you know, we can actually still do something about this. The window of opportunity has not closed yet. And here are some of the issues for us, particularly in Africa. This is the sort of African story on climate change, and here are our concerns and aspirations, given that obviously the talks are taking place in Durban, and it's the first time that these talks have been held in the African continent. Also, obviously, given that Africa is going to be one of the regions that is potentially will be hardest hit by climate change impacts. And of course, you know, countries like Kenya are already witnessing the impacts of climate change, for example, on farmers and pastoralists.
Well, exactly. I was going to say the message is particularly poignant because of this terrible drought that is affecting millions and millions of people in the Horn of Africa. Is the message they're taking that the drought is actually a result of climate change?
I think no scientist would say that a particular weather event is, you know, the result of climate change. I think basically in terms of extreme weather events, I think scientists would say that those kind of events are very consistent with having much higher levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But obviously on the ground, the way people experience is that they experience that, you know, periods of drought are getting much longer, much more intense, rainfall is much more sporadic, and that they basically cannot rely on having the same weather patterns that are absolutely fundamental to them to be able to plan and to plant their crops, etc. You know, they can no longer rely on having those stable, regular weather patterns. And that is causing people a great deal of extra hardship. And obviously, these are people, in many cases, who are already facing a lot of hardship. You know, they have a lot of problems to survive and to live well. And climate change is just adding, you know, another extra burden to them, basically.
The past conferences haven't yielded the hoped for results. What expectations, what hopes do you have for this event?
Well, we very much think, you know, we think this is actually another key moment. I mean, obviously, I think many of us got together. There was a huge movement, obviously, around the world and obviously within the Catholic community and in many countries calling for a global deal to cut emissions at Copenhagen in 2009. That didn't happen. We had some progress at Cancun the next year in 2010. And what we're looking to do basically here is we're saying governments need to deliver on what was agreed at Cancun, but they also, we really do need to push for action to get serious cuts in emissions, the kinds of cuts that we need that are in line with what science is telling us we need to keep the planet safe. So the two main things that CAFOD will be calling for is that countries continue to support a legally binding agreement on emissions cuts, so that basically that they support the continuation of the Kyoto Protocol, which, as you know, is due to expire at the end of next year. And the second issue for us is around making sure that governments live up to their pledges to mobilize $100 billion in climate finance for developing countries by 2020. And we want a process for that, a plan for how governments are actually going to do that. We want that to be agreed at Durban so they can actually get on with making sure the resources are there to support countries like the countries in Africa to make sure that those countries are supported to cope with a changing climate for the long term.
Maybe the fact that the world has witnessed the dramatic effects of poor rains in Africa this year will actually pressure world leaders to review their policies on climate change. Is that one of your hopes?
Well, yes. I mean, this would be one of the hopes is that we really basically that world leaders, you know, can overcome their differences and actually sit down around the table and come up with a serious plan for cutting emissions and for cutting emissions, you know, urgently over the short time, because I really think, you know, many expert commentators are saying, you know, we have a shrinking door here, a shrinking window of opportunity to really avoid the, you know, unmanageable climate change that will, of course, affect people who are already very vulnerable, like people in the Horn of Africa. You know, it will affect them the most. They have the fewest resources to cope. So, you know, that's a great hope, is that, you know, we in the West or we in developed countries need to really change our lifestyles and cut our emissions and move to a low-carbon lifestyle. But we also need to support people who are already being hit by the impacts of a changing climate, and to help them to build a different development path as well that is low carbon.
Sarah, I understand that this caravan of hope left Bujumbura on the 9th of November. Have you had any news from the participants along the route?
Yes, we've had regular blogs, regular updates from our three partners on the caravan. We heard the other day from the Mau Forest in Kenya, where there was a memorial held for Wangari Maathai. You probably know the Kenyan environmentalist who very sadly died recently. And she was obviously a great voice, a great African voice, speaking up, protecting the natural resources, the forests in her native Kenya, and obviously for protecting the natural resources of the African continent. So it was a very fitting memorial for her, basically.
Climate change has been on the agenda for, I'd say, at least 8-10 years now on the world agenda. Do you think that people's concept of climate change has actually changed? Has it sunk in? Let's talk about the general population as to how important this issue really is.
I think, for example, in the UK, I think it's very difficult, for example, for us to really understand the sort of magnitude of this problem. I mean, everybody has their own problems in their daily lives. For example, in the UK, we're facing an economic crisis. People are very concerned about their jobs. People are very concerned about what's going to happen to their own families. So I think it's very difficult sometimes for people to look at these bigger issues. But I think, at least in the UK, I think people know that, you know, climate change is happening. They know it's a real problem. They know it's caused by our lifestyles, by the way that we live, particularly in developed countries. And I think, unfortunately, nobody will be immune from those impacts. So, again, I think the urgency, perhaps some people don't quite understand the urgency, but I really feel that will increase as the impacts will increase. I think what we need is we need to have imagination and we need to have compassion and solidarity with people, as I say, in other countries that are already suffering some very terrible impacts of changing weather patterns due to climate change.
Sarah, will you be in Durban for the conference at all?
Yes, I will be representing CAFOD there and meeting with our partners who are, as they come to the end of their journey on the Caravan of Hope.
And what role will CAFOD have to play in the conference?
Well, CAFOD will be obviously trying to help support and represent the voice of our partners who, as I say, are already suffering the impacts of climate change, and we'll be lobbying governments and all the different negotiators that are there in what's a very complex process, trying to lobby them, particularly, as I say, at the moment we have our Don't Drop the Ball campaign, so we're trying to make sure that the UK government and other governments live up to their pledges to provide enough resources for poorer countries to cope and to adapt to a changing climate. But we obviously, a big question is the future of the Kyoto Protocol, which is the only legally binding agreement on emissions cuts. And we really, really need to try and preserve that and obviously to try and extend it in the future to take in all the big emitting countries.
You know, of course, that Pope Benedict XVI is behind you in his very forceful stance for the protection of environment. What value does his message have in the world today?
I think it's extremely important for the church to use its prophetic voice to really speak up about this issue, which really threatens, you know, the future of humanity and the future of the planet. And obviously, we as stewards of the planet and of all the natural resources, I think the church has an absolutely key role to play. And I hope that we will be speaking up, you know, very clearly sending a message to political leaders, to decision makers, that it really is time for serious action to cut emissions, basically, and to really support poor countries to cope with a changing climate.
That was Dr. Sarah Wykes, CAFOD's lead analyst on climate change and environmental issues. And now Vatican Radio's very own film critic Peter Malone makes a welcome return to tell us about current and soon-to-be-released films. Peter, who was ordained as a member of the Order of the Missionaries of the Sacred Heart, is at heart a real film buff and works at the International Cinema Desk of Cygnus, the World Catholic Association for Communication. I asked him to share his thoughts and his feelings about the film The First Grader, a moving movie about an 80-something old man in Kenya who wants to learn to read.
The new government has announced free education for all.
When I saw it, I was fascinated, and there's a feel-good element about this very old man, 84, who decides that he wants to become a first grader. He wants to go to school.
Good morning, boys and girls.
Can I help you, Mzee? This is a primary school.
But already in the opening, there are parents galore trying to get their children places in the school, and there aren't so many left. And they resent him at his age wanting to take one of the places.
Go home and rest in peace. I'm not dead.
But he says that the government of Kenya has said free education for all.
They said everybody.
And he didn't have any education. He would like to have some. And he has a letter from the government which he would like to read.
I'll be a good pupil.
We have a new student today. Open your exercise books. Let's begin.
So these are some of the motivations. And he goes, and it's a wonderful performance by Naomi Harris, very sympathetic as the teacher who takes up his cause and actually suffers for it when she's criticised, when the government are upset and some of the inspectors disapprove and they want her transferred, and her husband's wondering about what she's doing because he's in the city working as a diplomatic aide.
What's going on here?
An old man like him does not belong in a classroom full of children.
He's absolutely crazy!
Why are you risking everything because of this old man?
So there are all those kinds of elements as well. Now, here's where I need the advice. And I did ask a friend who grew up in Tanganyika back in the days, and it has information at the beginning about the Mau Mau.
Right.
And so he's
Mau Mau. Mau Mau.
He's a veteran Mau Mau.
Mm-hmm. British killed his family. We have a duty to help him.
And they do show flashbacks to initiation rites, to the pledge, and to some of the Mau Mau going out to massacre people in their homes. So you've got that underlying ambiguity, I suppose, because certainly if you asked the British at the time, and they are presented very unsympathetically, the military, then they were terrorists.
I was a prisoner. The British, they told us to be quiet. So we spoke very loud.
And now, of course, if you ask, they are freedom fighters. And so we've got the whole post-World War II, 20th century struggle with freedoms and independence as background to the film. My friend found that I don't think he could really forgive the Mau Mau for what they did to families that he knew. And yet he knows, of course, the freedom fighter issue, which brings us back, say, to South Africa and truth Absolutely. And reconciliation.
Brings us to Zimbabwe and what's going on there.
It does indeed. And so, and that's the worry, I suppose, with Zimbabwe at the moment, that you have terrorist freedom fighter despot and the uglier side of colonial freedoms. So there's all that going on as you watch the film. But as you watch the film, you can put that partly aside, except that then they show some flashbacks where his wife is killed and his children and he is tortured. And so, again, you're shifting the issues of the time, the colonial attitudes, the need for freedom, and the sufferings of the individual. And then seeing him, 40 years later, coming then to the school, helping the children sing songs and get a spirit of freedom.
Freedom!
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 And finally, going into Nairobi to make a plea for the teacher. And then being used by the media, sometimes anti, sometimes pro, and posters of himself around the city encouraging education.
84 years, going back to school. How old are you?
55.
You are a toddler.
But the other side of it is, it shows the suit and tie bureaucratic attitudes of those in government and government departments in the 21st century, that they might have thrown off British yoke, so to speak, but they have absorbed, actually, the formalities and the pomposities and bureaucratic nitpicking, say, of Western democracies. And so I suppose that's another underlying theme that is there.
Now, when I said feel good at the beginning, it's because for the small parts that I saw, a lot of African joy seemed to come through in the film because of the soundtrack, because of the setting, it's so beautiful, because of the children. It felt very, very energetic. It felt nice.
Well, that's true. And the school scenes are good. There's a little boy that can't do the number five. and he resents the old man, but the old man eventually helps him to do his fives. And when there is a new teacher imposed and they all go into revolutionary mode again, it's this little boy who leads all the children to want their teacher back. So, yes, there's that kind of feel-good in the songs that he helps them to sing. And actually you're left then with a feel-good ending, because the information is that he died in 2009, but he had gone to the United Nations to speak on education.
So he did learn to read.
Well, I'll spoil it slightly. He himself doesn't read the letter. He gets Naomi Harris to read it to him.
Have a letter. I must read it for myself. I have to understand.
Which is a device for us to hear the letter, which is a letter of congratulations on what he has done for the country of Kenya.
It's also a film on how important it is to remember and to not repeat the mistakes of the past.
It's that and the healing of memories. He is involved, I'd say, in a healing of memories and possible reconciliation. But the bureaucrats have forgotten the past and are reliving it and causing many of the same problems as bureaucracies of the past. So, nostalgia and regret.
We have to learn from our past. We must not forget. But we must be better.
And now Father Jim Brand reflects on the fact that we are soon to enter the second week of Advent, with a particular thought for those who spend the Christmas season in loneliness.
Hello, it's Father Jim. We're reaching the second Sunday of Advent. I'm sure there are lots of lights and things for sale and anxieties about Christmas. Where do we go? Who's coming? Oh, help, I've got to look after me. Oh, mother. I'm thinking of the people who have nowhere to go at Christmas. I remember being on my own one year for Christmas. It was all right. I enjoy my own company, but it was a bit lonely. I went to visit my Italian sister once, and she had flu. Her husband was visiting his sister elsewhere. And so she had a baby and she had flu. So it was just she and I. We had a good giggle. I had brought out a Christmas pudding, a baby one from London to Rome. And we pulled a cracker together. And in the local market, I bought a little piece of turkey breast. That was all right. That was all right. We enjoyed each other. I'm thinking of the people for whom Christmas is an unpleasant time. Perhaps because they have an unhappy home. When I was a child, Christmas was dreadful because my father was an alcoholic. And 3 weeks before Christmas, crates of wine and whiskey and gin and sherry used to come in. And I used to think, oh, help. One of the illnesses in alcoholism that is a family illness is that we tend to lie. I remember telling the man who drove the van, I was 12 at the time when he delivered all this stuff, sorry, he doesn't live here anymore. So he drove off. Of course, next day I got into terrible trouble. Who told the booze man that he doesn't exist here anymore? And then sometimes I used to drop a bottle or two on purpose, so that at least that was something less he could drink. Well, made no difference, he just bought more. You couldn't possibly win. But since then we used to have AA meetings, three of them on Christmas Day. It was wonderful. These holy, wonderful people used to have three lovely meetings on Christmas Day when everyone else was boozing themselves silly. And I used to go to AA parties. Oh, I'd never understood how people could be so happy without booze. So that is one of the pains that some people have at Christmas. And my prayer is for all those for whom Christmas is a difficult time, that somehow you'll find some peace and not join in the rat race, the vulgarity of it all. I mean, at the real Christmas, our Lord didn't have a rattle, didn't have boxes of chocolates. He probably had some milk from the cow in the stable, that's all. He is our Christmas present. And the love that he has within us is our Christmas present. Please, please don't be extravagant. Part of this awful credit thing in the world is everyone is living on tick. I know somebody who's got 10 credit cards and he can't pay the interest on any of them. It's a dreadful thing to live on tick. And I just hope those for whom Christmas is a worry that you have to impress everyone with the amount you spend, that for a change you'll enjoy simple things, especially the freest thing, which is affection and love. Oh, you can't pay for that. It's beyond price. Costs nothing. John the Baptist is appearing now. I'm not the bridegroom, he says. I'm the bridegroom's best man. Now, in different cultures, the bridegroom may possibly have an attendant, a special friend. In England, we call it the best man. His role is to get the bridegroom to the church on time and reasonably sober. And then having got him there, he sort of decreases a bit. He might have to look after the bridesmaids or give a silly speech at the reception. He decreases to let the bridegroom increase. And the bridegroom, the Lord, comes to us in all sorts of ways. We hear on one occasion he was late. I always used to say to brides, don't be late, please. Otherwise you'll give the organist a nervous breakdown, running out of tunes. Also, it's very discourteous to be late for your guests. I don't know why brides think they should be late. I think it's highly discourteous. We are their guests, the bride and bridegrooms. You mustn't be late for your guests. In our Lord's story, the bridegroom was late, and I always think that the 10 bridesmaids dived into the reception before the bridegroom came, and 5 of them were under the table, ran out of oil. Let's be alert and know that a bridegroom is coming to into our lives, the one who lays down his life for us, the one who's utterly committed to us. And so here is a chance in Advent, getting ready for the coming of the bridegroom, for us to feel engaged to him, to renew our promises to him, to recommit ourselves to the bridegroom who'll never abandon us. Come, Lord Jesus. And whatever role we have is like John the Baptist. We are to decrease, to let him increase in our lives and in the lives of others. Oh, we'll get confronted by our mixed feelings. Yes, the Lord confronts us with his goodness. He doesn't want to humiliate us, though. He wants to humble us and teach us how to return love for love. Amen.
You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.